From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The World Health Organization declared the coronavirus outbreak a global pandemic. Governments around the world are responding to the announcement with travel bans and other imposed disruptions to almost every facet of daily life as they seek to prevent imported cases while also containing the spread of cases within their own borders. Global stock markets continued to be rattled Thursday by the coronavirus outbreak and its economic fallout. In the United States, President Donald Trump proposed a group of measures aimed at minimizing the effects of the end of the 11-year bull market. President Donald Trump also announced a European travel suspension and floated a number of other measures in a national address that, for some, created more questions than it answered. Panelists, welcome. The situation here is unlike any other in my lifetime. Sitting around with other journalists and we're trying to discover something that really strikes a comparison, really very much struggled to find something that really compares to the overall disruption to global life, global markets, almost everything, entire cities shutting down. I want to take a look at this from a science point of view, from a daily life point of view, and of course, from an economic point of view, Kimberly. Let's start off with the countries that have been worst affected to this point. Josh, I want to start with you. What are the countries that have been worst affected, and what are they doing to try to mitigate the cases that they are seeing?
Yeah, well, obviously, the virus originated in China, and you know they had several thousand deaths, and really, a lot of the world rather looked on as China was going through this, and perhaps we should have panicked more then rather than now and taken more precautions. But China took massive measures. They shut down cities. I mean, the city of Wuhan, where it originated, was in total lockdown. In fact, I saw that President Xi has just visited Wuhan. So they are coming out the other side of it. But they took huge measures. I mean, they had tracking systems on every individual so that anyone with the virus, they knew where they were at all times. Things that probably somewhere like America, we wouldn't be that comfortable with. But they do seem to have flattened the curve, which is the phrase that everyone's sort of using at the moment, which is basically to prevent the sort of exponential gains in the virus each day. And if you flatten the curve, then your whole health system can cope with the number of people that it needs to look after. So that's the China story. And as I said, President Xi's been to Wuhan, so they feel that they are through the worst of it. Iran and Italy are the other two countries where we've seen really appalling outbreaks. The story out of Iran is difficult because we don't get a lot of great information out of Iran at the best of times. We saw this week mass graves being built that were visible from space. Many senior members of the Iranian government have tested positive for COVID-19, and it seems like the situation there is ongoing. And Italy is the Western country which has suffered most, has an old population, and has had several hundred deaths, and the country is in total lockdown. They started with a lockdown in the north, but now the whole country is basically in quarantine, and they're trying to get, as we said, to flatten the curve there. But Italy is really the country that probably in America and the UK and others are looking to Italy and thinking, well, if it can happen there, it can happen here. Because although they have a little slightly crumbling infrastructure in Italy, nonetheless, it's a wealthy Western country. And certainly in the UK, a lot of people feel that they're probably only 3 or 4 weeks behind a potential Italian situation.
And I want to bring Kimberly in for a moment. We have key people now in world governments who are being affected and either having positive tests, self-quarantining. And I think we even had a death of a health minister in Italy who was suffering from coronavirus. If this is starting to affect world leaders, how does that sort of cascade down to the population? That sort of creates another level of concern, does it not?
There are a couple different issues that brings to mind. Number one, it's been really hard, and I can say this from a personal as well as a professional perspective, to get Americans to take this very seriously. As we've been reporting and as I've been speaking with friends and family, it's been incredibly challenging to get people to believe that this is actually a serious issue that is going to affect their daily lives. And unfortunately, it has taken situations like what's happening in Italy, and it's such a tragedy there, and the fact that now we have a lot of world leaders as well as celebrities testing positive for coronavirus. You had the wife of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. You had the actor Tom Hanks. You're having athletes test positive. Now, the story of the basketball players here in the United States, you have healthcare workers who are struggling to get enough tests for their patients and for themselves. And yet somehow all 58 members of a basketball team were able to be tested within a space of something like 48 hours. And so it also highlights the testing issue that we're having here in the United States.
So are you suggesting that this is a case of haves and have nots, and there's some selective ability to be tested depending on where you are in society?
I think that's always the case with the American healthcare system. What you get is determined by what you have. And this is the difference between the United States and Italy and China and even Iran to some extent. Because as bad as the situation was there, that outbreak happened in countries where there is some sort of publicly funded, robust health system where sick people can go to the doctor and not have to worry about what it's going to cost them to get treatment. And that's why one of the key parts of legislation that's working through Congress and the White House are negotiating it right now, and several of these meetings that the president has had with industry leaders has been all about who is paying for the tests, who is paying for the treatment. We had a member of Congress really grilling the director of the Centers for Disease Control yesterday Thursday on the Hill to say, we have given you the authority to cover the testing. We've appropriated money for it. Can you guarantee for us that anybody who wants a test won't have to pay for it? And he hemmed and hawed for a while, but eventually said yes. But I think that is going to end up being the defining difference between how the United States makes it through this and these other countries, because we are the only developed nation that doesn't have some sort of universal health care for everyone, and the fact that cost is factoring into it, and that our system is so sort of segmented depending on your income level. That's going to matter. And of course, this is going to play into the debate around the presidential election.
Josh, I want to throw it back to you. And you mentioned the situation in China. And it seems as though China is sort of, to use a phrase, coming out of the other side, and sort of cases on the decline. You're seeing life returns to a somewhat normalized status. I'd heard that one of the signs that life is returning to normal there is that all 47 Apple stores are opening, and they consider that sort of a canary in the coal mine or bellwether there. What can we hope for by looking at the arc of the situation in China and determine where that is with other countries, and I'm going to say the United States in particular here? What can China tell us about where we are in the arc of situations here and in the United States and in other countries?
Yeah, well, we know that things are picking up in China because they've started pushing conspiracy theories that it was the U.S. that planted the virus. So that's how we know they're sort of back on their feet. As I mentioned earlier, some of the measures that were taken in China are just not things that we would really contemplate or even really necessarily have the capacity to do in Western countries. I don't think any of us really want to be tracked by our government in that way. Probably the best example of who's done a really good job is Hong Kong, which you would have expected to be very exposed. But they learned a lot from having SARS.
Yes.
About 20 years ago?
Yes.
What did they do? They acted very fast in Hong Kong. They shut down flights and they responded very aggressively from the outset. They did very aggressive screenings for anyone coming into the country, and travel restrictions, and they did do the travel bans. And I think the Trump administration has looked to China and Hong Kong and the travel bans that they did, and that was the thinking behind the travel ban that we saw in Europe, which took a lot of people by surprise this week. But I think it was inspired by some of the measures that were taken in China.
I will throw this question out to you first, Kimberly, and then, Josh, I'd like you to weigh in, too, as we come up on our break. This is a situation that is a global situation, and it cries out for global leadership. We're going to talk a little bit about leadership within the United States, but in many global situations, the United States has sort of taken the lead in this and served as a leader, sort of a beacon and a guide for where the world is going to go. Is there anyone who has stepped into that role as a global leader, someone to look to for truth and a direction here?
Well, I think the World Health Organization has really proven its mettle through this in delivering really clear, very up-to-date information. They had a testing regime that they were sharing with a lot of people that was very helpful. I do not actually think that it takes one leading global entity or person to address this crisis. I do think there needs to be global coordination among health officials, but as we're seeing in the United States and Italy and China, every community is different. Every healthcare system is different. The level of trust that people have in the information their government is giving them is different. And all of those things predicate a different response in different communities, different states, different countries. And so I do think that there needs to be global coordination on the science side of things, but I don't think it's realistic to expect that one key figure in the world could be at the forefront of this is how we should do it. The World Health Organization is saying social distancing, wash your hands, and that's a science thing. That's what's echoed by everyone. Exactly. And so I think aside from the scientific and the health elements of this, that it really is a local solution or at least a domestic one.
Josh, you weigh in on that topic. Is there a role for anything other? Certainly we need truth from the scientists, truth and valuable information there. Is there a need for a spiritual or a morale leader in a situation like this?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say that the president we have at the moment is not particularly interested in playing that role. You can think what you like of that. But I think it's fair to say that the previous president was. And I think some people, you know, maybe would have looked to him for moral, spiritual guidance and leadership at this time. But I do agree with Kimberly that the local differences are such that countries are dealing with this in very different ways. I mean, you look at the UK and America, which have a lot of similarities culturally, but the UK is taking a really divergent approach here. They're actually not advocating mass social distancing. They're not cancelling a lot of public events. They're leaving kids in school. Universities are still open. Obviously, people are taking precautions, but they're arguing that they're using sort of behavioral science to argue that actually, if your measures are too draconian too early, people aren't going to stick with them, and that actually people will start breaking the distance within a couple of weeks anyway, and that actually, in the long term, the disease may come back if you prevent everyone getting it now. So they've developed this kind of slightly different theory of the case, which is a big political gamble for the UK, and Germany is actually taking a relatively similar approach. So you can see just from there that countries with similar cultural backgrounds and similar economies in some ways are taking massively divergent approaches based on their own healthcare systems and their own reading of the situation, what their scientists are telling them. There is no one global consensus on how to beat this.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Let's go to the global markets. Markets continue to be battered globally in this economic fallout from the coronavirus outbreak, this pandemic. U.S. markets have lost virtually, if not all, of their gains from the Trump administration. We've had things like the circuit breakers that were put in place after the 2008 stock market crash to prevent massive, instantaneous, catastrophic losses. Those went off for the first two times since they were imposed. It's been not even a roller coaster. This has just been a deep dive to the bottom so far. Kimberly, I'll go to you. That's your expertise. I want to ask you this. Was this market response unavoidable based on the situation that we're faced with culturally, socially, politically?
That would require some sort of psychic knowledge that I don't really have, but I can sort of talk about sort of a couple of different elements of what we're seeing play out here. Early on, it was a bit of a roller coaster. We had these crazy swings over the last week or so where you're up, you know, the Dow is up 2,000 points one day and then down 1,000 points the next day and down, you know, 4% one day and then up 5% the next day. But now we are just seeing the down. And yes, those circuit breakers, for example, when the S&P drops more than 7% in a certain window of time, they just stop trading for 15 minutes. Let everybody take a breath, check what the losses are, have a look at the companies and whether or not they really want to be selling as much as that, and then go back into it.
And I just want to stop you real quick for a second there, because people have heard a lot about these circuit breakers. Is that what happens? Trading is stopped and everyone just gets to take a timeout, have a juice box and a cookie, and then resume after having reassessed the situation? It's just really an emotional timeout for the markets.
Yes, but also an algorithmic timeout. So much of trading right now is done with computers and artificial intelligence looking at what is being sold and the prices that are happening, and it triggers other actions. And so if, for example, something says, if you have a program that says, oh, if this stock falls below X dollars, sell, and then somebody else says, oh, if it falls below that dollar, sell.
So you get a cascading effect.
It's a cascading effect. Okay. And so the circuit breakers help stop that, and it's a juice box break, yes. Okay. But at the beginning of this sell-off, a lot of market analysts were saying, you know what, a lot of these companies have been overvalued for a while, and this is going to be fine. They can take a little bit off the top, whatever. But then once this drop really started happening, especially it really took off after the Fed did its interest rate cut, after the president spoke, nothing that anybody is doing to respond to this is making the markets feel any better. And I think that that is sort of the financial markets kind of coming to terms, in the same way I was mentioning earlier, that it's been hard to get people to take this seriously as more and more information comes out, as we get a better look at what's happening in Iran and in Italy. You know, people are really recognizing that this is going to fundamentally change how businesses are operating, how people move about their daily lives, and potentially what our political system looks like if, you know, either there is sort of the high death toll that some of the more scary estimates are bringing up for this, or if it means that there's suddenly public will to have universal health care, which is going to change the way that the markets operate. The travel industry is getting battered because airlines are having to cancel flights. People are afraid to travel. Theme parks are shutting down and travel restrictions are in place.
Huge events are getting canceled. Iconic events in sports and entertainment.
Sports. Oh, yeah, exactly. All the sports teams.
They closed Disneyland. That's how you know it's serious.
Exactly. When Mickey's goes home. Yeah.
And so I think that this is a recognition that things are going to get serious. On the other hand, these companies have, especially some of the bigger companies, are sitting on record piles of cash. Like if you look at an Apple or an IBM or a Microsoft, like, yes, their production is being affected, but these companies aren't going to go out of business. Now, there are some industries like the coal and the shale industry that are over-leveraged because debt has been very cheap recently. You know, a lot of companies have a ton of corporate debt sitting on their balance books, and it's going to be very hard for them to make those payments. And that's why the Trump administration is talking about maybe some bailouts. But most companies, if their balance sheets were okay heading into this, they should be able to survive. Small business is what you have to worry about.
That's going to have to worry about. Josh, your take on this, your opinion on what's happening in the markets, and also sort of the political aspect of this, because everyone wants to say this is not a political situation, but of course politics weighs into it for elected officials.
I'm no expert on the markets, but like everyone else, it's given me flashbacks to 2008, really, which is the last time I can remember this kind of instability. And as someone without a 401k, you know, the initial instinct can be like to think, well, maybe this doesn't really affect me. But as we know, that kind of market pain always filters through into the wider economy. The politics of this are fascinating. The president has really struggled to really grasp the magnitude of what he's dealing with here. And a lot of his instincts, and we've seen this play out in his speeches, have been to downplay it. You know, he's very proud of his economy. He's very proud of his stock market, and it's been a massive bull run. That clearly is coming to an end. And I think this president more than many politicians, has a really, really very strong survival instinct. I think his survival instinct is starting to tell him that he needs to deal with this, that he can't just downplay it, that this isn't a Trump thing where you can kind of wave a magic wand and run a sales pitch and tell people that it's all a perfect call or whatever. He needs to deal with the gravity of this situation. You saw he's attempting that with the press conference that he gave 2 days ago and with the travel ban on Europe, and he's starting to listen to what some of the scientists are telling him, but he's still really, I think, somewhat overwhelmed by the situation. I mean, he made several factual errors in that press conference. He got it wrong in terms of the exemptions to the travel ban. He said trades of goods and cargo were going to be banned and then not. You know, critics of Trump out there who say, well, this could be his kryptonite because Mueller didn't get him, impeachment didn't get him. But this is something that really affects people's daily lives. This is people's families, people's jobs, people's plans and diaries and really sense of well-being that is being affected here. So, you know, this may be something that the president can't just kind of bluff his way out of. Politics of this are going to be interesting. Obviously, we're in an election year, and if this thing does go long into the summer, then and the president doesn't start to sort of improve his handling of it, then I don't see how it couldn't really inflict massive damage on him.
Kimberly, I want to get to you with the politics of this also, talking about your assessment of the speech that he gave from the Oval Office, your assessment of that. And to frame that, I wanted to give you a tweet that the president made this morning talking about the situation of testing and why there aren't enough tests and why South Korea is doing more tests in a day than we've done overall. The president tweeted, for decades, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, looked at and studied its testing system but did nothing about it. It would always be inadequate and slow for a large-scale pandemic, but a pandemic would never happen, they hoped. President Obama made changes that only complicated things further. And he goes on to talk about how swine flu was a full-scale disaster and nothing more meaningful was done to fix the testing problem until now. The changes have been made and testing will soon happen on a very large-scale basis. All red tape has been cut, ready to go, exclamation point. The speech, and then using this as a frame for the president's political instincts for how to survive this.
Well, let me address the tweet first, if you don't mind, because this is the problem that we're having throughout this situation, is that misinformation about the situation that we're in and how we got here is contributing to the scale of what this crisis is going to look like. So a couple of points there. He talked about the Obama administration's response to swine flu. I mean, I will say that we haven't had an outbreak of swine flu since then. So something was clearly done there. And earlier this year, I was reporting on African swine fever, which was a big concern, which also has not reached the United States. So the CDC has been doing something. The Trump administration, in every single budget proposal that they have put forward so far, has called for cuts to the CDC.
Significant cuts.
Significant cuts to the CDC. Now, I will say that Congress often ignored those and continued to fund the CDC, but it's a little bit disingenuous to talk about the CDC not having the resources that it needs to do this kind of work. President Trump actually eliminated this entire section of the CDC that dealt with sort of global infectious diseases,
which was embedded within the White House so that it would have direct access to the president as a part of the National Security Council.
So that's important information just as fact. On the testing, the World Health Organization had a test. Many countries decided to use it and were able to roll out those tests. The CDC in the United States, we decided to make the decision to develop our own test. Private firms are developing their own tests. Some states are working on their own tests. So that played into our testing delay. That's just a fact. And, you know, perhaps our test would have been better. The first round had problems, but it's important to address the misinformation. Yes, the president has a survival instinct, but it's our role as journalists to sort of address these things. Getting back to the president's speech, there were some key flaws. Errors is what they were. And I think that contributed to the market situation. It contributed to the political dynamic because it showed many people that he really does not seem to have a grasp of the severity of the situation or necessarily be willing to accept how bad it is. And I think a lot of people were looking to see him in that moment at the Resolute desk say, you know what? This is a serious situation. We are going to treat it seriously. We have a plan in place, and we're all going to work together to get through this. But instead, he took the tack of talking about how great the response had been. It's going to be fine. We're going to get through it. And he didn't lay out a plan. And I think that freaked a lot of people out, including some of his Republican colleagues. That said, I was speaking on the phone to a friend of mine in Missouri who is a Republican, and she and her husband are strong Trump supporters. And they don't see any problem with his response.
Can I just jump in there quickly?
Please do.
I completely agree with Kimberly, but I do think that if people's families are getting ill, that is possibly one thing that could cut through this kind of political and media polarization, because you can't spin someone going to hospital. But, you know, there are some things that I think maybe will push through this kind of division we've seen in terms of people's information environment.
That is, unfortunately, all the time we have. Thanks to our panel, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. And I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.